Judiciary Committee is in order. It's January 29, and this will be the policy portion of our hearing this afternoon. So we are going to start with Senate File 41. Senator Dibble, why don't you come on to the table, and if you have a witness with you, you can bring your witness forward as well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 41 is a fairly simple and straightforward bill. It would simply add to the list of reasons why a person could not be excluded from jury duty their marital status or their sexual orientation. It seems fairly self-evident that that should be the case, but I'll just spend a minute explaining why we're bringing a bill forward.
Please do.
Mr. Chair and members, the Minnesota Constitution, I'll just read in its Bill of Rights from Section 4 and Section 6. The right of a trial by jury shall remain inviolate and shall extend to all cases at law without regard to the amount in controversy. And in Section 6, titled Rights of Accused in Criminal Prosecutions, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury. It goes on to say, in all prosecutions of crimes defined by law as felonies, the accused has the right to a jury of 12 members. And Amendment 6, of course, of the U.S. Constitution from the Bill of Rights, first 10 amendments to the Constitution, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy trial and public trial, a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury. And Amendment 7 also speaks about the jury trial. So, Mr. Chair, members, jury service is not only a fundamental civic responsibility, it is also viewed in our system as a way we guarantee the delivery of justice. And really, it lies at the foundation of our democracy, which, of course, is the government by and for its people. And it's really as basic as the idea that we're all equal in the eyes of the law. We all have the right to vote, to elect those who represent us in making the decisions of government. And of course, unfortunately, we know that our system and our democracy did not spring fully formed at the outset, but rather it's been a study in progress in fulfillment of those ideals. And in fact, it was until the last century, in large measure, women were barred from jury service. And it was really only in the 1980s that the last vestige of blocking African Americans from jury service was finally removed. That was a 1986 Supreme Court case known as Batson versus Kentucky. And really, Mr. Chair and members, when we exclude jurors on the basis of marital status or sexual orientation, we're really denying the ability to create a fair and impartial jury of peers, and we're doing it on a very arbitrary fashion. Because, of course, folks bring very important perspectives and experiences to jury service, regardless of that status or those statuses. So it really serves no one's interest in the cause of justice or in the justice system, whether that's the defense or the prosecution or the plaintiff or the defendant. So, Mr. Chair, members, this is just simply an effort to remedy a deficiency in our statutes and, of course, the corresponding rules that a court adopts for itself that is based on these statutes. That, Mr. Chair, I have Phil Duran, who's on staff, an attorney at Outfront Minnesota.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. As Senator Dibble has mentioned, my name is Phil Duran. I'm the legal director for Outfront Minnesota. We're based in Minneapolis, and for over 25 years, Outfront Minnesota has advocated for full equality for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals and their families across the state through a combination of direct service, education, and public policy. For more information about our work, please visit our website, outfront.org. Among the principles that motivate our work is a vision of a Minnesota where LGBT people have equal opportunities, protections, and rights, and are free to live without fear of violence, harassment, or discrimination. This commitment is particularly strong with respect to situations involving our state government. We believe that Senate File 41, which would extend current prohibitions against discrimination in jury service, is a step forward, and I'm here to respectfully urge the committee's support of this legislation. While it may be true that not every person who receives a summons for jury duty responds with unalloyed enthusiasm, it is nevertheless true that the idea that people are to be judged by and that parties submit disputes to juries of their peers, and this reflects the central importance of juries to our concept of justice. Without juries, our system of justice would quickly be thrown into disarray. Jury service is frequently and justifiably recognized as an important civic duty that each of us may be called upon to perform. And most people who serve on juries do find the experience to be informative and rewarding. A related concept central to the operation of our judicial system is the commitment to fundamental fairness, to the idea that each of us is entitled to our day in court and to an expectation that we'll be heard without bias or prejudice. The United States Supreme Court has held in cases such as Batson versus Kentucky and Powers v. Ohio that invidious discrimination in composing a jury so taints the judicial process and so fundamentally calls into question the integrity of the result of such a proceeding as to require new trials unaffected by jury discrimination. As far back as 1927, the Minnesota Supreme Court, in a case called Passer v. County Board of Renville County, held that discrimination against women in the empanelment of juries there was impermissible. The court adopted the principle that in constituting a jury, quote, there must be no distinction or discrimination against any particular class because of race, sex, or occupation. It is important to note that the court concluded that this discrimination was visited upon not just the parties to a particular dispute, but rather could affect the interests of anybody in that county with a matter headed to trial. Discrimination in jury composition is a matter of concern to our society at large. The Minnesota legislature has responded in part by enacting Minnesota Statute 593.32 prohibiting many forms of discrimination in jury service in this state. However, this statute, while an important statement of public policy, nevertheless is incomplete. 593.32 prohibits discrimination in jury service on the bases of race, color, religion, sex, national origin, economic status, and physical or sensory disability. In contrast, decades ago, this legislature also articulated a strong public policy against discrimination in public services, that is, government services, Minnesota Human Rights Act. Under Minnesota Statute 363.02, Subdivision 1, quote, is the public policy of this state to secure for persons in this state freedom from discrimination in public services because of race, color, creed, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, sexual orientation, and disability. Such discrimination threatens the rights and privileges of the inhabitants of the state and menaces the institutions and foundations of democracy. The lists of important personal characteristics which may not serve as the bases of discrimination in these two statutes are very similar, but Minnesota Statute 593.32, prohibiting jury discrimination, does not include two characteristics found in the Human Rights Act, sexual orientation and marital status. Senate File 41 remedies this inconsistency by adding those two characteristics to 593.32. Minnesota does not consider this question in a vacuum. At least two other states, California, through Rule of Criminal Procedure, Civil Procedure 231.5, and Oregon, through Oregon Revised Statutes Chapter 10.030, Subdivision 1, already explicitly prohibit discrimination in jury service on the basis of sexual orientation.
Mr. Duran, I'm going to interrupt you for just a second and note that we do have a quorum present now, and also I ask you to pull the microphone closer to you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
In the federal system, looking strictly at the criminal trial context, federal circuit courts of appeal are split, with the Ninth Circuit assuming, though not deciding, that the Constitution prohibits discriminating against prospective jurors based on their sexual orientation, and the Eighth Circuit ruling that it does not. The Eighth Circuit case, United States v. Ehrman, actually originated here in Minnesota, though as a federal court case, it would not have been directly affected by state law such as this. Additionally, earlier this month, members of both the United States House and Senate introduced legislation known as the Juror Non-Discrimination Act of 2013, with bipartisan support, which would explicitly prohibit discrimination in federal juries on the basis of sexual orientation. Existing federal law prohibits discrimination in this context on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, national origin, or economic status, a list strikingly similar to that found in Minnesota Statute 593.32. Minnesota need not wait for federal action in order to do what's right. We have longstanding commitments to the principles of non-discrimination in public services generally and in jury service in particular. This committee has the opportunity to strengthen these commitments by approving Senate File 41 and moving it forward for further action. And on behalf of Outfront Minnesota, I respectfully urge you to do so today. Thank you very much for your consideration of this proposal.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Duran. And just please remember to sign in on the sign-in sheet, though, before you leave the table as well. Senator Goodwin.
Do we need to move the bill?
Certainly, before we take any action, Senator Goodwin moves the bill.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for Senator Dibble or Mr. Duran?
Chair.
Comments? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, you've certainly made reference to constitutional references outlining our general principles of our republic, but I didn't get any direction or indication from you if there's a problem that you've seen in Minnesota recognizing discrimination on a jury selection process. I don't know of any cases like that, and I'm just wondering if you can tell me if there's a problem that we as policymakers don't know about in the state, or are you simply recognizing the references in our human rights statute? And since it appears as though the human rights statute was referenced in jury selection, that you're simply wanting to catch up to the changes, I think, that was made in 1993?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
I don't think those questions are, or the two parts of that question are mutually exclusive. To answer the second part, absolutely yes, that, you know, court follows the directives and reads the rules fairly plainly. And the fact that there's an omission here speaks. And it needs to be complete. But there have been problems, and Mr. Duran can speak a little bit more about those, both in Minnesota and in a number of other states.
The
experience of other states, which we wouldn't want to replicate.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I mentioned in my comments the case of United States versus Ehrman. It was here in the Twin Cities. It did originate in the federal court, but there's nothing unique about the situation that said it couldn't have come up in state. The situation was that Ehrman was a gay man who was on trial for some drug offenses, and there was a juror in the pool who was being interviewed by the counsel for the different sides, and they perceived him to be a gay man. I wasn't there, so I don't know what it was that gave them that impression. The attorneys went through asking the jurors what, various questions, including, what kind of relationships do you have? Not only family relationships, but worker, co-workers, things of that sort, which is important. Every juror was asked, are you married? And if they said yes, then questions continued. If they said no, then usually the prosecutor went on to a different type of question. In the case of this particular juror, he alone was asked, do you have a partner? And he said yes, and who is that? And he identified a person with a male name. And after that point, he was excused from the jury on the perception that he was a gay man. It was taken up on appeal. And even prior to that, the defense counsel, a man by the name of Kyle White, is an attorney here in St. Paul, raised a challenge and said this seems to be impermissible and that he's being discriminated or excluded on the basis of his sexual orientation. And the prosecutor acknowledged that he couldn't separate out the sexual orientation piece once he figured that out about the particular juror. But the judge upheld the exclusion, and the Eighth Circuit upheld that ruling. This is a fact pattern that could take place in any county court in any part of the state of Minnesota. And so what we are hoping to do with this is to cure a weakness in the statute so that we know that it doesn't happen, because we know that when it does, it really does ultimately cast a shadow on the proceeding in which it occurred.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Duran, I don't. Not everyone on this committee is new to the, or there. Many of them are new to the committee, and some don't know about the selection process attorneys go through to select a jury. There are plenty of reasons to exclude anyone from a jury pool for a variety of reasons, and even no reason at all. But those are limited to. And I don't recall how many one can exclude for no reason at all. Would this bill, if it became law, would it create any interference or damage to that court procedure of altering in any way the jury selection process for a non-specific purpose?
Mr. Chair, I'm
Senator Dibble,
not an attorney. Mr. Duran will answer this question in glorious detail that the Judiciary Committee, I know, loves. But the short answer is no. And in fact, it would, create no difference than already how the law currently operates. When these issues come up, they come up, you know, when these issues and questions come up about why a juror was excluded, they come up on the basis of a particular set of facts or circumstances and are sorted out, you know, in some other venue. But in terms of jury selection and peremptory challenges and that sort of thing, there's no interference in the normal process of jury selection. Mr. Duran can probably answer more eloquently.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, bearing in mind this is a statute that exists right now, it certainly does not affect the ability of potential jurors to be excused from service for cause. So, for example, if I'm the prosecutor, you're a potential juror, and I find out that you live next door to the defendant, or you're their cousin, or you go to church with them, I could seek to have you removed from the jury for cause. And this statute has never interfered with the ability of courts to do so. But what it does say is I couldn't exclude you simply because of your sex, your national origin, your race, your sexual orientation, those sorts of things, things that have been problems in the context of invidious discrimination for quite some time. Courts have not found that, as the law exists right now, has not found that to be a hampering of their ability to remove jurors for cause. And we wouldn't want it to be, quite frankly. We want jurors to be impartial. And if there is a cause, if there is a particular reason why a candidate may not be impartial with respect to a particular situation, no one would want to limit the ability to have them removed. Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, a couple things. First of all, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wren, what was the result of the appeal you cited? In response to Senator Limmer, you mentioned
sure.
A case that was under appeal.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, this is a case called United States v. Ehrman. It went up to the Eighth Circuit in which one of the points of appeal was that the federal constitution, building on the case law, started with Batson v. Kentucky in the 80s that Senator Dibble mentioned, it made it impermissible for the prosecutor to excuse someone based on sexual orientation. And the Eighth Circuit concluded that Batson did not extend that far. In contrast, the Ninth Circuit has held that it assumes that it does. So we do have a bit of a circuit split. The United States Supreme Court declined review in that case.
And Mr. Chairman, just to maybe respond kind of indirectly to Senator Limmer, let's remember a little bit of the history, and this does get into peremptory challenges. But in the South, in the 60s, and into the 70s, keeping in mind that jury pools were selected originally through voter registration rolls, you wouldn't find a lot of African Americans who were available for the jury pools because they couldn't register to vote. However, once you had the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 65 and you had African Americans with a greater ability in the former Confederate states to register, you still had difficulty where you had in criminal prosecutions, say a crime committed against an African American, prosecutors would, through peremptory challenges, would make sure there were no African Americans on the jury. And they wouldn't specify that as such, but it was very clear that there was that type of discriminatory pattern with Southern juries. And so that's where you started to see the Department of Justice come into jury selection. And I realized that with Mr. Duran's response that this legislation and in our history in the state, and Senator Dibble alluded to the same, wouldn't necessarily lend itself to the peremptory challenges. But we should remember the history in this country where there is no question whatsoever that the history in the Southern states was the utilization of peremptory challenges to ensure that you'd never have African Americans on a jury sitting in judgment of a white person accused of a crime against an African American.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen brings up a dark page in our history, although he limited the discussion to Southern states, but nevertheless, is there anyone in the room that would be from the court system in Minnesota that might be able to make comment about whether or not this is a historical issue here in the state of Minnesota? I noticed that there might be one person from the court system that is here, but to make a comment.
Anyone care to respond? Janet Marshall? Ms. Marshall, welcome to the committee.
Maybe I could frame the question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, go ahead and frame your question.
Ms. Marshall, the bill before you recognizes marital status and sexual orientation as a reference not to exclude someone on face value from a jury. In your knowledge of Minnesota's jury selection system, is this a problem that we're seeing in the state? Do you know of a noticeable number of jury selections that have been made on this basis?
Ms. Marshall, state your full name and your affiliation for the record, too, please.
My name is Janet Marshall, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I am not aware of any any issues that have come up or any problems that have been reported that they believe in the state court system, and I can only speak to the state court system.
Okay. Thank you.
Just by matter of process in response to Senator Limmer's earlier question, in the peremptory challenges, the attorney that might object to to an exclusion from jury service or a challenge that does not require a reason to be stated, after the process moves on a little bit, then the court would have a hearing to flesh all of that out. So it would not be held in front of the jury, but there would be a way to create a record that, and then the district court would make a decision whether they thought it was a lawful challenge or not. And that's the posture in which it then went up the circuit. Right. Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair, then are you saying that even though the representative from the courts hasn't seen any of that, that you've seen some of that discrimination or it's come out in the after discussion?
Senator Hall, well, my point was only as to how the process would work. And you can have an unlimited number of for-cause challenges as long as a judge finds cause was established. But in terms of peremptory challenges, they are limited depending on the nature of the proceeding. But my understanding, and I don't have the data in front of me, but my understanding is that the Star Tribune did conduct a study at one point looking at the LGBT discrimination in the context of jury selection and found some evidence of it occurring in federal and state courts, and that they did make some reference to Minnesota as well, but I don't have the data in front of me, and we're trying to find the specific reference for the committee's information.
And,
Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, we certainly have instances to cite in Minnesota, but also California, Massachusetts, and a few Missouri. So can't close our eyes to the fact that this is a problem that's occurring, whether it's occurring in small measure or large measure, material. The fact of the matter is if any trial excludes a juror on an arbitrary basis, it's not a trial that is conducted by a jury, a fair and impartial jury of a defendant's peers. It's an arbitrary basis upon which to exclude somebody, and it should not be allowed. And we know now from several cases that have brought forward here and other places that the courts have told us clearly, unless you're specific, this can be a reason for excluding someone from jury service. Plain reading on its face, that's not acceptable.
Are there any further questions for Senator Dibble or Mr. Duran? Senator Hall?
Well, Mr. Chair, I know Ms. Marshall came up. Was she referring to just the sexual orientation, or was she also referring to that she didn't know of any of marital status? I wonder if we could bring her back up and ask that.
Sure. Ms. Marshall?
Status is already under the
court. Okay.
Sexual orientation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, I have not heard of any for either category.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. For the committee's reference, court rule, General Rules of Practice, Rule 809, already does include marital status as a prohibited basis for excluding persons from jury service. But sexual orientation is not included yet in that court rule either, and this statute would address that question as well.
Mr. Chair, in 809, that's a statute, and so is that correct?
No, it's a rule adopted by the Supreme Court governing activities within the judicial system.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
Yes, Senator Limmer.
Senator Dibble, there's other bills that are floating around Capitol these days regarding marital status.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're an author of one of them.
Not yet.
Could this bill be considered a germane bill for amending on the floor of the Senate?
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it's a question that came to me from the media. I think that's why we have so much media in the room today. They're wondering if there's some surprise today. There is no surprise in this bill. There will be no surprises that I will be contemplating. This bill is my commitment on the record and in public that I'm only interested in this bill moving forward in its form.
Mr. Chair, in the event that a germaneness ruling would be in the favor of an amendment, and if that type of amendment was attached to this bill, would it be your intent to lay the bill on the table?
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I would seek, it depends on whose amendment. Senator Limmer, if it's your amendment, I would probably seek to defeat that amendment and proceed with the bill in its clean form. If it's friendly fire, if you will, yes, I would lay the bill on the table.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer is
Senator Cohen.
Referring to the gas tax, I believe.
Only when it's shared between two or more people in the same household. Senator Cohen.
All right. Senator Dibble, do you have any further testimony to offer in support of the bill?
One last question.
I do not.
Okay. Senator Limmer, you had a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We saw that the marital status is referred to in court rules.
Mm-hmm.
Why, or are you pursuing this through court rules as well, or is court rules enough, or is there a reason specifically to put it into statute as opposed to court rules?
Mr. Chair and members, you know, my only opportunity to express my views is through legislation. My only ability to solve problems, in a liberal sense, I mean, I can talk to the courts, I suppose. But it has been the history that Rule 809 has been amended in response to legislation that's been offered. I see that marital status is already included, but 809 has been amended in response to changes to the state law. I anticipate 809 amended in response to this state law. That's my intention.
Senator Limmer, it appears that the Supreme Court has not kept up with statutory changes. The last amendment noted in Rule 809 is from 1994 amendments. So at the time, marital status is in the rule, but statute has changed since that time. We'll ask if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to testify in connection with this bill, either for or against it. I don't see anyone else here. Any further discussion from the committee, Senator Hall?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just want to state, with all due respect to our good Senator Dibble, it sounds like we're trying to take care of a problem that isn't there, that may be coming up. And I'm not sure that that's the way we work. That's not necessarily the way I work, so I'll just be voting against this.
Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, I can't resist, in response to Senator Hall, gee, that's what we said about photo ID.
Mr. Chair, I remember a marriage amendment that seemed to solve a problem that didn't exist as well. My question in response simply would be,
Should it be all right to exclude someone from jury duty on the basis of sexual orientation or marital status? That's the question to answer. I hope the answer to that is no.
It sounds like the Eighth Circuit case indicates there's at least a perception that a problem may exist in the system as well. Any further questions or comments? If not, Senator Goodwin renews her motion that Senate File 41 be recommended to pass and be referred directly to the floor for consideration. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
The motion prevails.
Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Scalzi. Senate File 60. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and the witnesses with you.
Thank you, Chair Latz. I'm Senator Bev Scalzi, and thank you for hearing my bill. Thank you to the members of the committee. My bill is Senate File 60, relating to personal contact information. And I think Senator Goodwin is going to move the bill.
Correct.
Senator Goodwin moves Senate File 60 be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor. Senator Scalzi, proceed.
Thank you, Chair Latz. And then as we've heard comments about Senate File 60 during this process, we've been working with others to get their input. So I do have a delete all amendment, and that it would be the 60A-1 amendment, which wasn't in your packets originally, but I think has been recently been distributed to you up at the table. So I would like that moved as well to get the bill in the shape that I would like.
Okay. Senator Scalzi, we're going to ask Senator Goodwin to withdraw the motion at this time, and we'll get us procedurally in the posture, and then we'll do that. But do we have the amendment? Has that been handed out?
Move the amendment. Is this
Goodwin
the A2 amendment?
Amendment in front of them?
There it is.
Okay, Senator.
Move I'd move the A2 amendment.
Okay.
It's the 60A1.
I'm sorry, the A1.
Senator Cohen moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 60, which is before us. All right, Senator Scalzi, why don't you describe.
Thank you, Senator Cohen and Chair Latz.
This is your first committee, so.
It is. It's so exciting, but I didn't bring donuts or anything, so I'm sorry for that.
You can't eat a bowl.
This bill, Senate File 60, would create protection of personal email and phone number information. And I know that Senator Limmer has been working on a similar bill. We've kind of been going on a parallel path here, and I thank him for that. We've had a short conversation about that. This bill does have bipartisan authors. I wanted to just explain the delete all amendment just briefly because it addressed the clause that which would allow sharing with other government agencies. It took that clause out, and it also addresses the concerns of the Campaign Finance Board, who at this point does not have any opposition to the bill. So Senate File 60 would allow local governments to not be required to share personal contact information, as is in current law. The League of Minnesota Cities has been working on this issue, and the Minnesota Newspaper Association is not opposed. The Minnesota School Boards Association supports the bill, and they are here as well as a member representative of the Campaign Finance Board if there's further questions from members of the committee. But here we have some testimony from, first of all, Chuck Aull, who is the Assistant City Manager of Maplewood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to share the situation and put a perspective to the need for this bill. The City of Maplewood received a request for all information related to emails collected by the city, literally for information ranging from our listserv, which we collect emails where people sign up online for information ranging from city council agenda, information on park and recreation programs, information at our community center, to snow plowing updates, information that they can sign up and simply give their email, and then we'll send out, like this morning. We were out putting salt down. And so the people that had signed up for that got an information that our crews were out at 3 a.m. Certain of these programs have various numbers and people associated with. To give you an idea, we have 17 different programs in the city of Maplewood, the largest being we have one that has 2,997 people that have signed up for information. In addition, last year you may be aware that the city of Maplewood decided to create a single hauler in our trash collection. As part of that process, the city of Maplewood purchased trash carts for all our residents. And as part of that program, residents were asked to sign up and coordinate what size and cart they wanted and the service. And as part of that, they provided us their contact information, including their email addresses. That particular list created over 6,000 names on email addresses in the city of Maplewood, which, for you put it in perspective, that is over 60% of our properties in the city of Maplewood who received that, and with the provision that was only to be used for the information related to trash carts and shared accordingly. With the data request that we received last year, we ended up having to release that information, and it was provided there. It took us a number of weeks to compile all of that information. We had it available and then released it to the particular individual. Obviously, you're aware, we certainly couldn't ask what it was to be used for. We're not allowed to do that, and we did not. But as at this point in time, it creates a burden for the city. Obviously, we were able to provide the information. But from our perspective, the information that our residents signed up for was very specific and not certainly the intent to be used and disseminated to the others. Thus, the city of Maplewood certainly supports Senator Scalzi in her efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. All. Senator Scalzi?
Yes, and we have another testifier here from the League of Minnesota Cities.
Thank you. Mr. Hines, state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. Mr. All did a great job laying out the issue as it applies to Maplewood, and the same issue applies to every city in the state that maintains listservs, that receives emails from individuals complaining about how their street is plowed or registering any sort of complaint. We believe and that the expectation of an individual citizen when they contact their government is that their email address is not going to be given out to a solicitor or an interest group or any other third party who requests it. And these listservs in particular are very important because they allow increased transparency, they give more information to citizens, and they do it in a quick and cost-effective manner. And we are afraid that as more and more individuals make requests for these email addresses, it will dissuade people from signing up, and we're going to be getting information out to fewer and fewer people, and it really defeats the purpose of trying to get information out. So that's where the bill came from, and the legislation would make that those email addresses, telephone numbers, which are often used to send text messages about snow emergencies and other similar information, private data. And the League fully supports it. We worked over the summer and fall with our member cities to develop this policy, and we're very pleased Senator Scalzi has brought it forward to the committee today. And I'll be happy to stand for any questions the members have.
Any questions for Mr. Hines? All right. Senator Scalzi, I understand maybe some others that you have brought along with you to testify. Is that correct or no?
Actually, they're here if people have questions of the Minnesota School Boards Association and the Campaign Finance Board and the Minnesota Newspaper Association. If members have questions, we could call them up.
Okay. I'll note we'll welcome former Representative Denise Dietrich, who's here on behalf of the School Boards Association. And I will note also, members, in your packet, you have some written comments from Matt Ayling from Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I don't know if he's here and intends to testify or not, but it's in your packets along with some other information. Is there, there being no questions at this time, we'll see if there's anyone. I'm sorry, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Scalzi. I do have a question for the newspaper organization. Just like to know their thoughts on this. I know they are, as part of transparency, I know they're one of the groups that will go out and do data requests, and so I just like to know what they think, and then I have a follow-up question on public safety.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Member Senator Dietzick, it is our strong tradition for many years here that government transparency equals government accountability, and that has to be a priority, especially for the news media. On this particular bill, however, we've looked at it carefully, looked at the underlying factual context. We don't believe that public access to these kinds of email addresses, such as the list from Maplewood, is really in any substantial way linked to government accountability. So, I mean, I would never sit before a Senate committee and say there's a right to privacy, for goodness sakes. Don't let me be heard to say that. But in this, there's a balance. And in this context, the names of the folks who contact local governments will be public. What they say or what they do will be public. Technical things like the email addresses, I think we can live with that.
Mr. Anfinson, would you just go ahead and state your full name and your affiliation for the record as well?
I apologize, Mr. Chair. Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association.
Any further questions or comments for Mr. Anfinson? All right, there are some other individuals that wish to testify. So, Mr. Newmaster, if you'd like to come forward. Newmaster.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Rich Newmeister, and I represent nobody. I've just been around for a long time, as newspaper recently said, a fixture at the Capitol. I've done many things over the decades on transparency, accountability, and access to information. I oppose aspects of this bill, and I'll get right to it. If you look at the A1 amendment, it's the term "or informational purposes." To me, it's a vague term. You can run a Mack truck through it. When I have asked from the League of Minnesota City representatives what informational purposes, I don't really get a clear answer. I posed out the situation as follows. Let's say, for example, a number of people are asking of government of information, making requests for information about what's happening in their neighborhood or whatever, by email. And again, a lot of things, if you look at communication with government by email, a lot of it is being done by email, but no other kinds of information, not saying who they are or whatever, but by email. If there's important and citizens, people within that neighborhood or that community or one particular issue start to see those kinds of things, they may want to say, what's the issue, whatever, and may want to contact some of those people. This is not listservs. See, the main purpose of what the legislation was intent to, and what Mr. Berglund, if you look at the NPR piece, is on the issue of listservs. I think this gets into one of the major things, as I call a tradition of Americana, is the debate on issues in our community. How many times have we asked, or you ask of information of a government entity, and you might say, are there other people asking that same kind of issue? And one of the ways to fight government sometimes and to work other than yourself is to find out others who are of similar views or similar likes or similar problems. One of the first questions that have been asked, and which has been public for almost nearly 35 years now, I'm interested to take a look at the request for public information or stating what some problems are and wanting information on it. But I want the people or contact information. So then I, where others can sort of say, hey, I'm in your same situation. Now, I beg to differ with Mr. Anfinson, who represented the Newspapers Association, on this perspective. And the packet of information that you have from Minn Koji is also made up of not necessarily newspapers, but of journalists and citizens and librarians who to use these kinds of things. Let me share with you another experience that the trend is happening, and it's the issue of unintended consequences. Already when the bill's out, all of a sudden you have the ethical, whatever it's called now, the campaign disclosure, the old disclosure board come in and say, we're thinking that this bill might have an impact on the ability to share information. Now, I don't know how many other items are out there in the statutes that they have an impact on. Thirdly, where I was starting to say about the modernness of things, government is basically, in many ways, requiring email addresses if you want to get information. So let's say a local library, a presentation is made on budget cuts or to close a local library, or it could be a state agency for whatever it does. Hey, if you want more information, hey, just sign up on the list here. For informational purposes, not a listserv, but for informational purposes, and then all of a sudden, there might be some bad consequences of that decision. The public wants to engage for that neighborhood, that community, or whatever interest group that might be. Hey, can I have the names that you collected who want further information so I can contact them and to give my point of view or sort of say why this is important for the government not to do these kinds of things? So it stifles, I think, that rich, enriched tradition of information, of community talking to each other.
Mr. Neumeister, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have a question for you on that point. How do you limit the use of that information if it's requested by a third party, and they wouldn't have to say that they only want to use it to communicate with those individuals on that topic? If it's public data, then they can just request it, and then how do you limit its use beyond that?
Mr. Chairman, I'll say there's difference in apples and oranges in regards to a listserv of snow plowing, you know, when the snow plow comes out, versus the collection of maybe 30 names of people who might want to get some information on the, you know, on the closing of the library, and you might want to organize people in your community. And so I'm not here on talking on the listservs. Now, about the use, the legislature historically on information, voting things, whatever, has basically said that you cannot use it for marketing purposes, you cannot use it for certain kinds of things, but you can use it for political purposes and other kinds of things, you know, of what is recognized as First Amendment rights. You can do it that way. But see, I look at what language you do here in the unintended consequences. Informational purposes is a big thing. For 35 years under the Data Practices Act, I've been able to basically find out who's making data practices requests, public data practices requests for information. And one of the things, and you have to look in, one has to look in their heart and soul how they view the tradition of enrichment of debate and organizing and making government accountable through the people, not necessarily through the media. But a lot of that is trying to see who are of like-minded or of similar views or of different views to try and encourage a number of people to do this. We all are familiar with the DVS situation that just happened. Millions of dollars that a lot of state entities are going to probably be on the poll for. And one of them is when language is done 10 years ago, it all rumbles through my head being here for so long. They had legislation that said that when you interact on a computer at 2 in the evening or 2 at midnight or whatever, 2 in the morning, the government's not going to be able to, that your public information about one, what page you saw on the internet or whatever is not going to be public. The government will know for its own services, but it's not going to be available to the public. But who know that 6 years or so many years later, when people want to find out who's being looked up, who's looking them up on the DVS, all of a sudden they can't because they're referring to the statute, which was never the intent in the first place. That's the concern that I have with this language or informational purposes when it can't be explained to me. I think it's just and that the discretion is with the agency. So the agency can, in its own way, say, Mr. Neumeister, we're not going to give you the contact information in this circumstance or this situation or whatever it might be. I've worked with citizens and the public members on many of these things over the years to fight. they'll say, I'm sorry, we interpret that as informational purposes. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would just like to encourage to delete or informational purposes. I think it's the intent is what the intent is, but when you put or informational purposes, it's much broader and I think brings many more problems in the long run. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to thank you very much. And as you know, I do this for no money. I do this based on the principle and the strong feelings and all I've tried to do over these decades of service, and it's voluntary public service, is just to make sure that you get good information to make good legislation, not bad information or different perspectives that can cause bad legislation and have a bad impact on the citizens of Minnesota. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This is my first time I've appeared before your committee, and I'm looking forward to it in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Neumeister, I would just say that I'm all for open government, having everything out there that the government does that we can get out there. But this is different because these are people that are contacting the government. It's not the government that's doing it. And there's got to be some private data that you're willing to support because this isn't our government. This is the people that are contacting our government for whatever reason. And if you're going to say that somebody might want to know if there's other people in opposition to an issue, then are you suggesting that that the content of the emails gets shown as well? Because that would be the only way that somebody could determine. Otherwise, they have the whole list of everybody's name, everybody's email address. And what if there are people that are abused or trying to hide their from whoever their abuser is? And then you're going to give them all that information and everybody in the city that has contacted the city. There's got to be some data that's private and that at least government has in its hands, but not everybody gets to share that because even if they can't sell that data, what are they going to do with everybody's phone numbers and email addresses unless they're going to solicit them in some way for something, even if it's just to find out if there's anybody else in the city that agrees with them on a certain issue? There's got to be some way to protect people that are trying to get a hold of government. Maybe they're whistleblowers. Maybe it's somebody that's saying all the city crew does is stand on their shovels all day long. You know, maybe they don't want people to know that they reported that or whatever. And even with the campaign finance board, they're not going to hand out email addresses of people that have contacted them to say one of us politicians is not reporting certain data unless they do an investigation. And then they have to say, but they're not going to. And I want people to be able to say if we're doing something wrong or we're not reporting things appropriately on our campaign forms or something. But I don't want their names to have to be exposed if they're good enough to try to stop something, whistleblow, and stop something that shouldn't be happening in this field. So where is the line on what is private for individuals? Where is that line with you?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, you and I have interacted for, you and I were talking, 85 years. I've worked with you as a lobbyist when you were lobbying and helped protect the privacy rights of public employees. But we've been on the other side. On this particular venue, I've tried to balance. I've been very clear. Listservs and all that, I have no problem with them being private data. Concern I have is the language that I pointed out, informational purposes. What does that mean? And there's a vagueness to it to where I think the government can use it wisely and unwisely and also can have some mischief with it. And I've tried to share with you some of those examples because for decades, one of the things that, like I indicated to you, is where people are interested to be able to see some commonality. If they have the same concerns, they'd like to make contact with those people. Now, the way to do that contact is by maybe sending an email. Hey, I saw that you asked for the same information about this problem down here. I want to let you know I've had the same problem. Maybe we can talk together. And that is sort of left up and it's in the air when I cannot get a straight answer from the League of Minnesota Cities rep whether or not this would include data practices request. And see that, and that's where you, in your wisdom, hopefully you may ask those kinds of questions, or that's up to you as a body. I'm trying to point out to where some things to more effective accountability and transparency. Now, some folks are going to say that there's no accountability. There's no accountability factor about this getting access to this kind of information. There is. When people get together and say, you know, there's a problem here and there by the contact, it may not be the news media giving the public accountability, but it's the citizens that are giving the public accountability. So that's what I'm just trying to point out. I think that it's a good bill. It's a positive bill. I mean, I would rather not, but it's the way the technology is moving. I'd say take those three words out and then move on and see how it plays out. So, Mr. Chairman, once again, I thank you.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Neumeister, you and I share a lot of vision on the same perspective on data privacy, but one of the foundations that I think you and I have always agreed on is protecting the information of private citizens. And in this case, I'm curious that now you're advocating to, as a, let's say, a political, not a political, but a policy-driven activist, you now want data regarding citizens inquiring or known to maybe promote a cause that you might agree or not agree with. And are you violating your own principle of wanting, as an outsider, to grab information on the political views of a group of citizens that are petitioning or trying to bring a subject before a political entity?
Mr. Neumeister.
Chairman Lance, Senator Lemmer, I take each issue at a time, and I've been described in the newspaper as an open government and privacy advocate. And that's true. You, depending on the issue, you wear your hat. I have over the decades and try to balance this. The issue about political views or whatever it might be, it's been public for decades. If I want to find out if someone sends an email or a written letter to the Director of Public Works or Commissioner Jessen or anybody, they think health care is bad, this is happening, my streets are not being plowed or whatever, that's always been public for decades. And we'll still be able to be public, the content. The issue is the contact. Now, that's where you get back to the definition of what or informational purposes means. And see, things that have been public for decades, you know, you've got 300 municipalities, maybe more, 87 counties. You got hundreds and hundreds of agencies who have their own council and their own responsible authorities. They're going to interpret these different kinds of ways. And I just think that it's important in the leadership of the legislature to have a little bit more of what the impact of what informational purposes means.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lindman.
I like the direction that Senator Scalzi's bill is going, and I have a different version of it that I pointed her in the right direction, but I didn't have it formally written, and so I hope Senator Scalzi looked at it. But
yes.
I don't want to go past this. Senator or Mr. Neumeister suggested that he wanted to have a list of those citizens that would avail themselves of government officials, but would that mean that, in that perspective, does that mean that if I had a number of people writing me as constituents telling me how to vote, that upon the request of Mr. Neumeister, I'm supposed to give that list up of the constituents that are trusting me with that information? In the past, I have my own personal policy that I will not reveal the identity or the subject matter of when a constituent contacts me. It's almost as sacrosanct as a priest in a confessional that you don't reveal that unless you have the permission of the constituent revealing that.
Senator Lemmer, we have some information on that question.
Yeah,
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, there is a special statute that does deal with correspondence between elected officials and individuals. And those are protected. Those are private, although either the sender or recipient can make it public. Mm-hmm. So for the entities under the Data Practices Act, that would apply. So now, if it was a city council member in an email back and forth, that would be protected under current law. But if it was this, you know, city administrator, it wouldn't be.
So it'd be, this bill would make reference to more of a wholesale list, not of a specific purpose. But, Mr. Chair, I think Senator Scalzi is going down the right path. I could just imagine that there may be a number of civic-minded citizens that want to tell government in their right to say whether we're doing the right thing, or they might have some suggestions to make that idea better, or maybe they might have the gall to say we're going in the wrong direction. And I don't think anyone else should. And if it's done in a collective way, or if it's on a list of some means that somebody can ferret out some type of added value that would make it a purpose for either a government purpose or a commercial purpose, I just think that we're becoming too much of a collector of data for someone for perhaps a nefarious purpose. Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring up for discussion the A2 amendment. It doesn't really change Senator Scalzi's bill, but it does recognize a few details that we should talk about.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Senator Limmer, are you moving the A2 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer moves the A2 amendment. Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you have the A1 and the A2 side by side, you'll make reference to line 4 as any government data request on public schedules or activities of the government entity or private. It's a little little more tightly drafted, and it's actually, I think, good because it is narrow. It's not covering informational or notification purposes. It's literally supposed to limit this to schedules of snow plowing or school closing or other activities like meetings or things similar to that. I know that in Senator Scalzi's language, it's kind of, we've used the terms on her page, line 1.5, the words collected, maintained, or received. That's already in Chapter 13 that this bill makes reference to, so you know, it's more of a stylistic thing. It probably isn't needed as long as we make reference to Chapter 13 because those references are already there. Other than that, it's just a slightly narrower purpose, but I hope it's going in the right direction.
Senator Scalzi?
I would like to have that question answered by Patrick Hines from the League of Minnesota Cities.
Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer. Looking at the A2 amendment, I do have some concerns about what that language would and would not cover. For instance, one of the most common uses of a listserv would be to distribute crime data. For instance,
what data?
Crime data. So I live in a certain precinct, and they may send a list that says there is a burglary, robbery at such and such address, some other crime was committed. I don't know that that data constitutes an activity of a government entity because they were criminal acts that a third party performed. So I'm concerned that this tightens it down too much because there could be things that aren't technically a government activity that the government would be distributing to citizens. And the crime records are just one example that come to mind. And you know, public schedules, I think the A1 amendment certainly encompasses public schedules. I think there's near universal agreement on that should be included. I think it's, you know, we would prefer the A1 amendment that Senator Scalzi introduced.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
On the reference of criminal activity or a criminal investigation at a particular address, I can look in the back of my local newspaper and find that information. So I don't. It's been a long, at least, activity of that type of record to be made public. I don't think we hide that from anyone. I think it's part of the public discussion. If there was a call to that address, if it was an act of an investigator quietly determining that something happened, a criminal activity happened in a particular home, that would be considered investigative data, and that's considered confidential data. And so I think that may already be covered.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't think I articulated my concern very clearly. I agree that the criminal data, if there was a robbery that occurred at a certain address, is already public. If what we're getting at, if someone requests that sort of criminal data, that criminal data is not an activity of a government entity. So requesting that data would not fall under this language, and therefore an email address of a person who said, please send me all the crime that happens in my neighborhood, wouldn't be protected. Is that clear? I'm not arguing that the criminal data itself would be made private. That all the content remains public. I'm just concerned with how it's drafted that it could be too limiting in describing what information is being requested by a citizen.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
that's a good point. I think what I'm going to do is withdraw my amendment and then continue to work with Senator Scalzi if we can tweak the language between now and the next stop.
Next stop will be the floor if it passes, Senator Limmer.
That'd be fine.
All right, the A2 amendment is withdrawn.
Well, by the way, Mr. Chair, this is Senator Scalzi's first time she's been before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
We should turn it down.
Wow.
We know we have quite a tradition of dealing with people who have their first bill before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Wrote it down.
Senator Limmer, you're doing a good job of showing that tradition. Senator Sharon.
May I ask Mr. Neumeister a question before we move too far along here?
Of course.
My head's a little slower on these subjects.
Mr. Neumeister.
If I understand what you're saying correctly, I'm trying to understand what you're saying to make a better decision about whether I think it's a good idea or not. You're saying because somebody comes to a public meeting, no matter what it's on, informational meeting, seeks information from the city through a city newsletter, for example, that because they connect with government, they give up the right to privacy around that connection. As soon as you engage government, it should be assumed that all data is now public because it's connected to government. And to restrict that, so you're saying that the public should already know and assume that the data that they give to the government is public. And to change that and to restrict it in some way, especially the information, even listserv, would restrict the potential of an individual or groups to get trends or to see patterns of interest similar to their own. They can't say how many people have made inquiries to the city around this building permit or something like that, and thereby restricts their ability to organize or to put together more than a singular voice in interacting with their government. Is that what I understand you to be saying?
Mr. Neumeister?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon? Yes. In regards to listservs, not necessarily. No, I'm not on the issue of the listservs. It's what is called other informational purposes. So I was just asking Mr. Grunhofer, who is the general counsel, legal counsel of the League of Minnesota Cities, if he was going to advise the cities, if this passes as is, that when people ask in a similar situation about, hey, what's happening in my neighborhood or whatever, or I have concerns or I see a problem, so could you then share with me what you're doing on it, which would be informational, which has all been public for decades, and when you want to see who people of similar ilk of views, so you could coalesce to organize, other than what you call, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, more than the singular voice, that could be denied, which now is not the case, the contact information. The content of a letter or email is generally all public on those kinds of things that you and I, that Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon and I have been discussing on that point. But the contact, when emails is now becoming the only information you get for contact or to identify the individual, and if you want to communicate them, that, I think, will no longer be available to what you were describing, that coalescing to see if people are of the similar ilk or the similar view to where you can fight the permit, the city hall, or the state agency that might be doing things. Because this applies to state agencies, too, not just local government. It's a good question, and I hope I've tried to clarify, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, what you've asked. I think it's one of the important things of locals to find out who are people like me who might be having problems with police or the potholes in my neighborhood or a state agency that is not doing too good of a job and been asking for information. Contact information is one of the key points. And with the trend where emails, if you see a lot of emails these days, it's the email address, the point of view, and not necessarily a name with it. If the name is with it, that would be public. But the email contact information would no longer be public if this bill passes as is.
Senator Sharon?
Yeah, maybe we need to give the Tennyson warning, which says that if you give your email under any promises, that there's a chance that it'll be used for purposes purposes other than those that you intended. But the conflict that I'm having here in my mind is that if I'm thinking myself, putting my name on a list for the City of Mankato's newsletter, and I'd like to have all of the information that's distributed through that newsletter. It's also school district information that comes that way. But I'm not sure I want somebody using that email list for other purposes. So I do understand that if I really were heightened in my awareness about that, I might not be willing to share that information. I think that there is another recourse for the group that you're talking about, other than having access to the data collection that the city has, as they do now, to gather groups of common interest, common voice. This is a balance of whether or not you're going to make that easier for people to do than it is right now, against the right of individuals to say, it's only with permission. Maybe you have to have a check off here that says, I have to give you permission to allow my email to be given out for any other purposes than the one for which I've signed up for.
Mr. Neumeister?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, again, I want to make the distinction of a listserv, which is hundreds of people in your newsletters that want to send out that type stuff. You sign up for that, which is different than where I, Rich Neumeister, send a letter to the police department, and I see that there's been some problems with the police department on these things. Could you please send me some information about that? And I do it all by email. That's basically a request for information purposes. I see one or two or three in my community happening, whether it be police or what you're saying about tearing down. We're not talking about hundreds on a listserv. We're talking about
Senator, excuse me for interrupting. Sure. I understand what you're saying. Let's say email didn't exist, and we were under the old snail mail system where you wrote or you telephoned in and asked for some information on robberies in your area. How would the goal that you're achieving access to occur under that system?
Under current law, well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, all that would be public. I'd be able to get the name. I'd be able to get the full address, which I would still be able to do if they still do snail mail. So I'd be able to see, there were three letters in the last 2 months about the same problem that I had concerns about, and I could go and get their regular addresses and say, I'd send them out a letter, say, you know what, I've had the same problem. If you're having the same problem, and this happened 2 months ago, maybe we can get together and we can talk about it and talk to our city council person about it. Now, if it's a telephone, the point of view is the telephone call, hello, how are you? Yes. And if people take the notes, yes, I talked to Johnny Jones, and the issue was about police brutality, and you want more information about that or whatever, that's public.
Senator Letts, may I just ask?
Sure.
Senator Scalzi, in the past, I'm talking about pre-email, pre-internet, if somebody made an inquiry by telephone or somebody in the city, League of Cities may want it, or I wrote and asked for that, was there a data collection of that phone call or that? Did the city keep addresses and names of people who called and requested information?
Senator Scalzi?
Chair Latz and Senator Sharon, I would assume they do keep track of that. You know, this is interesting to me because I served 6 terms on a city council. And if there's anything that we cherish in our democracy and in our local governments, it's the fact that you can correspond with your city hall. And it's very easy, and you have no fears of somebody else getting your information. Now, to tell you the truth, I don't know the inner workings of the city, but I'm assuming that all of that information wasn't given out to anybody who came in the door and said, I want to know all the people in town who've complained about their potholes. And it's kind of chilling to me to think that somebody could do that, because the people that contact their city halls, that's their first order of business with democracy. And they're very trusting of their city officials. This is your first chance to contact an elected official. And it's very important that those people feel a freedom and that they're not going to be contacted by anybody else, like a pizza company who wants to sell more pizzas, or anyone else who doesn't agree with you, for instance. Say if you call in and for one reason or another, and then there's somebody out there who doesn't agree with you, well, now are you going to be barraged by letters or emails because they disagree with you? That could be quite frightening, I think, in my book. And I appreciated the comments of Senator Limmer, because there is something to be said about the freedom of contacting your local elected officials. They're the closest to the people. They're closer than you and I are. And I just think that we're going to see other data privacy bills this year. We're going to see the DVS bill and other bills that I'm not carrying. But I certainly would not think, in all my years of public service as a local elected official, that I'm leaving my people open to harassment or whatever. I was just at a Mountains View City Council meeting last night, and every city council has television cameras, and people can come in and contact and talk with their public officials for a certain period of time. And it's all open and public, and one person did last night say that she was disappointed in the police department. And so that's out there. Anybody watching their local city council on TV would know all of that information. You don't have to be able to contact her and yell at her about something if you don't agree with her. That's, I think, would be troublesome.
Senator Scalzi, it sounds like that contact information, even though you're concerned about it, is, under current law, all public. And so the question I have is, what's different about the particular kind of data targeted by your bill that heightens the need for making that private, whereas contact information by snail mail or telephone call and the notes taken and the subject content of that is already public? And you've got 3 kinds of data that are specified in your bill: telephone numbers, personal email addresses, and paragraph 3, the internet username, password, protocol address, that kind of thing, which to me certainly seems to be deserving of protection. The other 2 items, I think, may be more the nugget of the policy question that we're trying to sort out here. And so for me, the question is, what's different about the email communication kind of data that should cause us to might consider making that private, whereas if the communication was some other form, it would be public. Senator Dietzick, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it kind of goes on to yours, but it's also for Ms. Pontiac. So as a elected official, if I'm hearing you right, my correspondence or a county commissioner's correspondence that may have information on emergency assistance requests, and so it's got some personal data, or a constituent who's contacting their county attorney, or attorney might be a little different, but their county commissioner because they have a domestic abuse issue, or their that because it's an elected official is already private. What if they are contacting the police and they are going back and forth with the police, emailing them about information on a stalker, and so the police department has information, has their email address and IP address, and maybe they've changed their phone number a few times, and so they have a current phone number for the person, or the social worker that is in Century Plaza that is not an elected official but is working with somebody who is going through domestic abuse and has left the house and is trying to, for safety purposes and public safety purposes, hide from an abuser. What of is this information here? So all of a sudden, the stalker person or the person who is the abuser knows that that person is signed up on either a listserv or has, again, communicating with the police. So if they go and do a data practices or privacy request, whatever it is, on the police department, do they have to give that information? And so they can just do a broad request on anybody who's emailed or phoned within the last 6 weeks, knowing that this person has done that. Is that all public data? And so we're putting this person potentially in harm's way.
Ms. Bonius, do you have an answer?
Mr. Chair. Senator Dietzick, all the kinds of things you're mentioning there, there's other statutes that come into play. There's a law enforcement data statute, which does protect a lot of the data you're talking about. You've got the welfare data statute for the social workers. So depending on the context, a lot of that would be protected by other law.
Mm-hmm. Senator Dietzick.
Okay, so that's good. So then if they're contacting, again, I'm just trying to, because I appreciate what Mr. Neumeister is doing in trying to make this open, because I do believe we want open government and transparent government, but I think there are certain times when people's email addresses and phone numbers and should be private, and so for safety purposes. So I just want to, you know, make sure all of this somewhere in here is thought of. So again, if they're signing up for a list with the city council or the police department to get the crime data. So again, that goes to if that is public, or if I sign up to my second precinct newsletter and the stalker knows that I am probably interested in that, is my IP address and any information I give them public? If this is not here.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, yes, most of that would be, if it's just for general purposes, you're just signing up to get information, that's what you're talking about, then that would be public now.
So, thank you. So, again, if I am being stalked by somebody or harassed by somebody or abused and they know that I probably have signed up for this, that is one way they could get information.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that would be a kind of a creative backdoor way, I suppose, of trying to do it. Just sort of going on a fishing expedition and trying to find if by chance it comes up in some public database someplace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does anybody know? I mean, does any of the cities or League of Cities or any of the other cities, do we know if people do that? I know there's some creative criminals out there.
Mr. Neumeister, do you have an answer to that question?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick, again, my long history here is that you plug a hole, there's another way to find out. So, I mean, I've seen the continuous march of making data private for a lot of good reasons, but then people are able to find out another way. And another way how people are finding out is by the private providers, who dig up a lot of information, and then people pay $5 for the information because they have what the private sector has profiled you in such a way that you can probably get a good 3 or 4. I mean, I do it on the internet when I was looking up for some people when I was out at the inauguration trying to look up some old friends. I was able to just how they profile people. So it's done. It's always a catch-up kind of thing. Technology is moving very fast. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick, on the item about what this bill would do in that situation, the law enforcement people want like the Amber Alert, not the Amber Alerts, but those kind of things you were talking about, crime alerts. On the listserv, this language could cover, would cover this kind of thing. The notification is broad enough to cover that. So those are things I don't oppose. What I'm opposing is what "or informational purposes" means. And that's what the stressness of the stressingness that I've been trying to, not being stressed, but stressing to you as committee members the problems and the concerns.
Senator Gooden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the campaign finance board. Somebody from the campaign finance board, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Assistant Director of the Campaign Finance Board.
Could you pull the mic closer to you, please?
Sorry. Jeff Sigurdsson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Campaign Finance Board.
Sigurdsson?
Senator Goodwin.
Sigurdsson, yes.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Sigurdsson, I'm wondering here, under the piece that is for you, and maybe counsel can advise me too, I want to make sure that you continue to get all the data that you make public on us politicians and lobbying groups and so forth. But I also want to make sure that this doesn't limit the ability of an individual to report on somebody or ask somebody without people being able to get that data. I'm wondering if that hole is plugged so that you can give information and you don't have to tell. Example I'll use myself. Somebody wants to report some possible thing that I've done on my campaign report or whatever that they don't think is appropriate. Are they still going to be able to do that without you having to give out their names with the way this is worded in this language?
Mr. Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, the individuals who file a complaint, the information in the complaint is not available to the public until the board finishes its investigation. At that point, the information in the complaint is made available to the public, so you could find out. Also, the individual or committee that was the complaint was filed against would also have that information at the time that the complaint was made. But again, in terms of to the general public, there would be no release of that information until the investigation has been finished.
Oh, Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up on that. So you're saying that already the individual who the complaint is being made on gets that information even before an investigation is conducted. So they right away know who's complaining about them and what the complaint says immediately before there's even decision whether or not to do an investigation or not.
Mr. Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, the process of the complaint is first reviewed by the executive director and through the board. If the complaint is accepted, at that point it is made available to the individual being complained against. Anonymous complaints are specifically prohibited in Chapter 10A. So once the complaint is accepted as being for a valid point, that information is shared with the individual or committee that the complaint is against. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Sure. Senator Blatz.
Senator Sherrod, and then we'll go to Senator Lindner.
Just a couple questions. First to you, is this the only committee that this bill is in front of?
Yes.
Does it go to local government or anything like that?
No.
Okay, thank you. Then I will ask this question, Senator. Is there anything in Section 1, Paragraph B, that takes away the responsibility of governments to give a Tennyson warning, to inform people under any circumstance, whether it's for informational purposes or for notification or for listserv? Is there anything that takes away the obligation of government to inform the public that there is that they are giving data into a public entity and making public, that the potential for that information to be public is present the moment that they start to give information, that there is a risk for them when they start to distribute information, just as there is when you start telling your story to your physician and you apply for insurance. At that moment, you, or anytime somebody puts a document, a chart in a chart, that as soon as that starts to be documented, there is a risk that you lose control of the privacy. And is there anything, and if this isn't going any other place than this, then I need to know that that protection for the public still is in place, even though you might be with the bill restricting the responsibility of government to distribute this information.
Senator Sharon, I think Ms. Pontius can answer your question. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, I mean, the way the Tennyson warning works under law right now is it only applies if you're being asked to supply private or confidential data. And so if you're providing data that's public, you don't get any kind of information at all. Now, what the language in the bill does do, though, is to specifically say that warning is not required for these types of for this type of data. So if somebody, you know, makes a request to be on, say, the email alert for snow plowing, they wouldn't get a Tennyson warning as part of that request. And, I mean, part of the reasoning behind the Tennyson warning is that if somebody's asked to provide that kind of protected data, that they should have a right to know. It's private, but these other entities might get access to it. So under this bill, you wouldn't get that warning. I think part of the thought behind that was that this is information somebody's voluntarily providing rather than something the government's asking for. But, then, you know, that's a policy question for you to decide to.
Thank you. And Senator Lantz, just to follow up, Senator Scalzi, my experience with this is in the healthcare field, and I don't think people that come to see me simply because they're voluntarily coming to see me as a clinician and voluntarily giving me information so that they can get from me what they need, that they understand what were the risk that they're taking at that point. So the basis that it is voluntarily asked for as a rationale for not giving the Tennyson warning concerns me, because I don't think the public in general really gets that once you engage in the public world that it is under many circumstances public information. So I hope you would look at that and consider this language.
Senator Sharon, what you're really suggesting is an expansion of the Tennyson warning's applicability, which is a much bigger question for consideration. Certainly might be of relevance here as well, but might be something worth looking at. Okay. In a broader context as well. Senator Scalzi, you wanted to respond?
Just as a matter that I've, my experience with the Tennyson warning, for instance, I have a heating and air conditioning company. I need licenses in various cities. So I go to a city, and I'm giving them my money, and I'm filled out an application. So I'm requesting them to give me a license. They give me the Tennyson warning to warn me that now my Social Security information, all of my information is open information. And frankly, it's a little scary when you give someone a Tennyson warning. So I don't know that we want to go down that road in this, because I know the fear that I've had in that situation, because I'm giving my bank, I'm giving them my check. So this is a little different situation rather than somebody asking the government to do something for them. This is, they're just asking to be notified. It's not they're asking for a procedure from the government. I think it's very different. And the medical field may be different as well, but I don't think this would apply in that case.
Senator, former Senator Tennyson, did you have anything you wanted to add to this? I saw your hand go up. You don't need to, but I saw your hand go up. Maybe you can.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Robert Tennyson. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and I do not represent anybody on this issue. I think the question about the warning is interesting and important, because the purpose of the warning was to inform people that you're collecting private or confidential information and that they have some choice as to whether they want to proceed with the proceeding. The idea that with private or with public data, since it's all public anyway for every purpose, there's no need to give that warning. And this bill makes an important exception because it basically makes information private, but it takes away the warning. And I know we don't talk about what goes on in the other body, but there was some testimony in the House on this issue about some of the uses that the cities put this information to, and they do share it with other organizations. So I think you need to explore that.
Oh,
Thank you. Senator Goodwin?
Close to that point, the one concern I would have is that this doesn't address the name and address of the person. So that would still leave that open as public data. And my one concern with that would be, again, with people that are not wanting to be contacted by somebody who might be stalking them or abusive or whatever. And is there any reason why we didn't also include their name and address in this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, you know, one of the issues with home addresses, there are a few reasons. One, when you sign up, when you send in an email, an email might not have your home address on it anyway. It might not even identify your name.
Sure.
That was one reason initially why it wasn't included. Obviously, home addresses are more public in property records and other contexts than an email address, which is, more private because you create them at your will and you can, create new ones. You can have an email address that doesn't identify your name. So home addresses were, I think, viewed as already relatively public. I mean, if you wanted to, if you were concerned about an issue in the neighborhood, you could easily mail a letter to every home in the neighborhood addressed to resident. I mean, people do that already. So I think those are a few reasons why home addresses were not included.
Well, then, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. Then we leave a hole here because people can still now, if this passes, can still request some the names and addresses of those people that contacted the city or the school district or the school board member or whatever. They can still get private information on people. So anybody that calls, the city would still have to keep track of their name, and they'd have to hand that out if people asked for that. A person that, wrote a letter and had their home address on there. And there are ways to protect for abused women and people that are being stalked. There are ways to keep your name off of the property records and so forth. There are ways that you can do that now, legally you can do that, so that you can't be found easily. But this one would still make them have to report to it. If I walked into Columbia Heights City Hall and said, I want the names and addresses of anybody that wrote you or called you on a certain issue because I want to send a letter out to them telling them, write letters to the governor to support this bill of mine or whatever, I could still do that. And so that kind of leaves a hole. And I would just like to see that added. And I'm not going to make an amendment here now, but I would like to see the name and address added as well to make it clear and that we don't want this information.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring up the A2 amendment again.
Senator Limmer, I'm going to ask if you would hold that thought for a moment. I'm sensing among the members a bit of uncertainty about whether or not the format of this bill is comfortable for the membership, and perhaps Senator Scalzi, the fact that this is the first big data practices bill that we've considered in the committee, and we're kind of using it as a vehicle to learn a little bit more about the whole scheme of things, as you can sense from some of the questions as well. So I'm going to ask for a little bit of guidance from the membership, if you're comfortable perhaps laying this bill on the table for now so we can address some of these other questions that have come up and maybe reschedule it. We certainly will get back to it. This is not the kind of bill I think that we want to deal with from an amendment standpoint on the floor of the Senate if we can avoid that. It's better dealt with in committee. And Senator Scalzi, you're the chief author of the bill. Do you have an opinion as to that procedural suggestion here?
Chair Latz, I think that would be a fine suggestion, and I would accept that because we certainly want this bill, since it's going to the floor, we want it to be right. We don't want to be arguing about this on the Senate floor. So I would suggest that we have a small committee work on this, and maybe Senator Goodwin and Sharon and Limmer work with me and the League of Minnesota Cities to get it in an appropriate form that we think is going to pass and bring it back to the committee, if that's your desire.
Okay, well, I'm going to Senator Limmer on that point.
Just for a little parameters, when we do meet, I wanted to raise a question on line 6, the reference to or informational. It's kind of a broad term. It could be used for many different purposes. It probably needs to be tightened a little bit. And the difference of the A2, the Limmer Amendment versus the A1, is that the A2 was going to close down the information on name, address, city, and zip code and make it private, whereas the A1 amendment wasn't going to allow that. It was only after the telephone numbers and personal email addresses. So I kind of am hearing in the committee that they want protection of identification on their citizens, and we got hung up when we presented the A2 amendment originally on the word activities, and maybe a different word like meetings or something would be better, further constrained. But anyway, we'll have lots of things to talk about whenever we get together.
Yeah, Senator Scalzi, I'm going to recommend, as the bill's chief author, you can pull together whichever other senators you think would be interested and helpful and keep working on it. I'll commit to you that we'll give the time to return to the bill. That being the case, I think at this point we're going to lay the bill on the table. And thank you for the good discussion, and we will return to this bill at a different meeting.
Thank you to the members of the committee. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
What we're going to do now, members, is we're going to gavel out of the Judiciary Committee and return as our Finance Division so we can take up budget issues. So the committee is adjourned. And.